What I'm going to tell you about in the next hour to kick off the summer school is how quickly we can multiply in finite fields. I've written down here some standard examples of finite fields. For instance, someone might give you the field Z mod 2 to the 255 minus 19, that modulus is a prime, or someone might give you Z mod 2 to the 61 minus 1 and adjoin a fifth root of 3. Here's a couple more examples. Last one is maybe the other extreme from the first prime field example. You might have a characteristic 2 finite field, Z mod 2 adjoin T mod some irreducible polynomial over F2. The question here is, someone gives you a finite field, how quickly can you add, subtract, and multiply in the field? Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to write software that adds, subtracts, and multiplies elements of whatever finite field somebody has given you. I have a cautionary note down at the bottom here that the speed of your addition, subtraction, multiplication, well, obviously it depends on the field you're given. If you have a big enough field, the bigger your field gets, generally the slower your computations become. But also, the speed obviously depends on your platform. If you have a very fast CPU, then your multiplication is going to be faster than if you have a slow CPU. What's perhaps not obvious is that there's interactions. Those two effects, those two dependencies are not orthogonal. If you have a different platform, I've written down some examples here. If you have a different CPU, like an Athlon UltraSpark, or an 8051 is a small 8-bit CPU used for washing machines and occasionally for cryptography. A Spartan 3, that's an FPGA, or maybe you're writing circuits, you're designing circuits, writing code in Verilog or VHDL, and depending on what your platform is, you'll have different speeds for different finite fields. If, for example, you're using a big CPU like an Athlon or an Athlon 64, then the fastest fields will be big prime fields like this first one, Z mod 2 to the 255 minus 19, whereas if you're designing circuits, then your fastest fields will be fields of characteristic 2, such as this Z mod 2 adjoin whatever. I'll explain some of the platform-dependent effects in a little while. I have a few slides here on the context. Why do we ask this question of how quickly can we perform field arithmetic? Well, one of the operations, one of the bigger operations you can build using fast field arithmetic is modular exponentiation. Somebody gives you a number n, which has, say, 256 bits in it, n's between 0 and 2 to the 256 minus 1. Using fast field arithmetic, you can compute the nth power of 4 modulo 2 to the 262 minus 5081. That's just some prime that's been chosen with some cryptographic security implications. It might seem that if n is very big, then computing this gigantic power of 4 would take a very long time, and then dividing it by 2 to the 262 minus 5081, finding the remainder, would also take a while. But even if n is very big, you can compute this 4 to the n mod some prime by repeated squaring. You square and square again, square, say n is 2 to the 255, you just have to square 255 times, reducing your intermediate results, mod 2 to the 262 minus 5081. If you have n not being a simple power of 2, then occasional multiplications by 4 will give you the desired 4 to the n. More generally, if somebody gives you 4 to the m or any number mod p, and you want the nth power of that, you can go through the same computation, repeated squarings and occasional multiplications by 4 to the m or whatever the input was. There's a couple of big time savers here. One is speeding up your multiplications, your squarings in this finite field, and another speed up, which you'll hear about later, at least in the case where your base is something like 4 to the m instead of a small number like 4, you can save time by using short addition chains and trying to optimize exactly what sequence of multiplications you do. Working backwards, working from, for example, 4 to the n backwards to n, working from 4 to the n mod some prime backwards to n, seems to be quite a lot more difficult than computing 4 to the n from n. Inverting this function seems substantially more difficult than computing it. Because of that gap between the difficulty of computing this modular exponentiation function and the difficulty of inverting it, because of that gap, it seems possible to share secrets through a public conversation. This is the Diffie-Hellman system. I've written up at the top P is the same prime, 2 to the 262 minus 5081. How does the Diffie-Hellman system work? Well, there are two parties, Alice and Bob, who, sitting in the same room without having any pre-shared secrets, are going to have a public conversation and at the end of it end up with a shared secret that other people have trouble figuring out. Alice starts by generating a secret number M, say 256 bits, and Bob generates a secret number N, say 256 bits, and then Alice performs the fast computation I've talked about, computes the mth power of 4 modulo P. Bob computes the same thing with his secret number N, obtaining 4 to the N modulo P, and now they publish that information. They exchange, Alice broadcasts 4 to the M mod P, so Bob can see it, and Bob broadcasts 4 to the N modulo P, awfully difficult to say, tricky tongue twisters like Bob broadcasts at this time in the morning. Alice, now seeing 4 to the N mod P and using her secret key M, can take the mth power of 4 to the N mod P, and Bob, starting from 4 to the M, which Alice broadcast, and starting from Bob's secret number N, can compute the nth power of 4 to the M mod P, and that's the same thing, 4 to the MN modulo P. So Alice and Bob, by performing these easy modular exponentiation computations, can figure out this same secret number, 4 to the MN mod P, which apparently is difficult for an attacker to figure out. If you're listening to this conversation and you're not seeing the secrets M and N, if you're just seeing 4 to the M mod P and 4 to the N mod P, then figuring out 4 to the MN mod P, even predicting a little bit of information about 4 to the MN mod P, seems to be difficult. This is the Diffie-Hellman problem. If you could work backwards from 4 to the M mod P to M, or work backwards from 4 to the N mod P to N, then you would be in the same position as Alice and Bob. But that seems to be difficult. And all the other methods that we have to compute 4 to the MN mod P from 4 to the M and 4 to the N mod P seem to be much slower than modular exponentiation. It seems difficult for an attacker to figure out that shared secret. However, it's not as hard as we would like. You're going to hear later not just about addition chains and various other things I'm mentioning here, but also about index calculus, which solves the discrete logarithm problem much more quickly than you might think. It's still much slower than modular exponentiation, but it's not as slow as the simple methods you might imagine. And in fact, it's fast enough that we can do this computation without too much work. If you want to stop the attacker from using index calculus, if you want to protect against the fancy methods that we have to perform discrete logarithm computations, you could use a much larger prime. And eventually, index calculus becomes very slow. You could replace 2 to the 262 minus 5081 with some sensibly chosen larger number, big enough to resist all of the attacks that we know, including index calculus. Unfortunately, that makes the arithmetic that Alice and Bob have to do quite a lot slower. If Alice and Bob are trying to do this a lot of the time, if their computers are busy servers trying to handle a lot of secret communication, then this is a serious problem. Elliptic curve cryptography is motivated by this slowdown. Elliptic curve cryptography, instead of working with powers modulo P, works with scalar multiples on an elliptic curve group modulo P, and you're going to see all about how that works. The virtue of this is that even though it's not as fast as 4 to the N mod P, it's still not as painfully slow as working with a much larger prime. Elliptic curves seem to be immune to index calculus. The slowdown here, I've written on the slide, the arithmetic is somewhat slower, but it's not as slow as replacing the prime with a much larger prime, which is what we would have to do to preserve the original Diffie-Hellman system. Whichever of these approaches you take, you need to do fast multiplication. You need to do, when you see elliptic curve arithmetic, you'll see multiplication is one of the critical operations in performing the elliptic curve analog of the Diffie-Hellman system. So you need to have fast addition, subtraction, multiplication in a finite field. I'm going to focus on multiplication as the critical operation here. Addition and subtraction are generally quite easy. The first question, the question that's going to occupy me for most of the remaining time today, is how do you multiply big integers? How quickly can you multiply big integers? Now, if you ask someone, some kid coming out of school, how to do this, then what he'll tell you is, of course, integers are represented by pulling integers back to polynomials by the evaluation at one ring morphism. Well, maybe that's not exactly what kids say. Evaluation at one, I'll get to that later. Evaluation at 10 is what I've written here. You use a polynomial in radix 10. You represent your integers as polynomials in base 10. For instance, 839 is 8 times 10 squared plus 3 times 10 plus 9. The way you say a number, you're representing it in radix 10. Your polynomial coefficients are digits between 0 and 9. Okay, I'll give several examples in a moment. When you've represented integers in radix 10 or radix 1, well, I'll get to the variations on this. Let's say radix 10, then multiplying integers is pretty much the same as multiplying polynomials, with one extra step. You have to carry. You have to account for the difference between polynomial multiplication and integer multiplication. You have to take the larger coefficients of your polynomials, larger than 9, that might show up, and replace them by, well, carried coefficients until you've converted your polynomial product into an integer product. I'll get into all the details of that. What I want to emphasize about the structure right now is that polynomial multiplication involves multiplying small integer coefficients. You might say, wait a minute, the multiplication of big integers, if you convert that into multiplying polynomials with integer coefficients, then the polynomial multiplication involves multiplication of those integer coefficients, so this sounds circular. How do you do that polynomial operation? Well, what's important is that the polynomial operations involve small integers. So you've split one big integer multiplication into lots of small integer operations. For example, let's square 839. As I said, 839 is conventionally represented as 8 times 10 squared plus 3 times 10 plus 9. In other words, it's the value at t equals 10 of the polynomial I've written down, 8t squared plus 3t plus 9. If you want to square the integer 839, you start by squaring the polynomial, 8t squared plus 3t plus 9. And I did that and came up with 64t to the fourth, that's the square of 8t squared, plus 48t cubed, that's 8t squared times 3t, plus 8t squared times 3t, plus etc., and there's all the five coefficients of the square of this quadratic. That's not a legitimate representation for the integer square of 839 because the digits are too big. I insist that each integer be represented, at least Child's answer insists that each polynomial be represented as the unique minimal polynomial, each integer be represented as the smallest polynomial, each coefficient being between 0 and 9. You might complain about negative numbers. I'll get back to them later. How do we convert this polynomial into the desired integer result? How do we reduce these coefficients? Modulo, well, t is 10. You just start carrying. You take 81, for example, and divide that by 10, producing a remainder of 1, and carry the 8. Take away the 8 there, add it to the 54, producing 62, and then take 62, divide by 10, producing a remainder of 2, a quotient of 6, which is added to 153. Continue in this way until you've found the polynomial representing the integer square, 7t to the 5th plus 0t to the 4th, etc. In other words, 703921, 703,921, that is the square of 839. What is the data flow here? What operations did we need on small integers? Well, looking at the polynomial product, here I've written a piece. This is just a small piece of the, much too early in the morning. Here's a small piece of the polynomial square and the carries at the end. At the top, I have computing 153, which you can see is the middle coefficient of the polynomial product. That came from the 8, 3, and 9. I multiplied 8 by 9 and came up with 72, multiplied 3 by 3. For another way to get t squared, multiplied 9 by 8, giving 72, another coefficient of t squared. Adding 72, 9, and 72 produced 153, the middle coefficient, the coefficient of t squared in the polynomial. If I did a complete picture, then I would have several more similar operations for the other coefficients of the polynomial. What happens in carrying? Well, coming in from the carry of the 6, 62 produces a 6, which enters this data flow diagram. 6 is added to 153, and then the result, 159, is divided by 10, producing a quotient of 15, a remainder of 9. 9 is one of the output digits, and 15 is carried. It's added to the 48 later in the picture. So the basic operations here are multiplication and addition and division by 10 with remainder of small integers. I mentioned you could evaluate at 1 instead of at 10. There's lots of choices here, and I'll come back to how those work later. Instead of representing 839 as 8t squared plus 3t plus 9, it's often convenient to insert the missing zeros into the polynomial and represent 839 as 800t squared plus 30t plus 9. If you want to square the integer 839, then you can again do it by squaring the polynomial and then using the fact that t equals 1 to eliminate unnecessarily large coefficients. The square of 800t squared plus 30t plus 9 is, well, it looks just like the previous result, but lots of extra zeros in there, 4 extra zeros with t to the 4th, 3 extra zeros with t cubed. You recognize the 153 from before times 100t squared, etc. The carrying process looks very much the same. Take 81, one of the coefficients of the polynomial square, and then divide it by 10, producing remainder of 1 and a quotient of 10. Well, you don't have to, a quotient of 8. You don't have to take the 8, just take the 80 and add that to 540, producing 620. Keep going. Eventually, you end up with the scaled representation of 703921. Same result as before. You can see the same computations are happening here, just with lots of extra zeros. What operations were used in this picture? Well, very much the same. The polynomial squaring involved exactly the same operations of multiplying and adding coefficients that were given to us in the first place. 800 times 9, for example, is 7,200. 9 times 800, 30 times 30, adding those up produces 15,300. Same computation as before, just with some extra zeros. And then the carrying process, instead of dividing by 10, and producing a quotient and remainder, we divide by 1,000 here is the appropriate number for this point in the computation, and then obtain a remainder of 900. The quotient we don't need, just subtract the remainder from the original 15,900, producing 15,000. You remember from before, 159 being carried, well, 15 is carried away from that, and 9 is part of the result. Here, same thing happening with the extra zeros, changes the intermediate operations. Instead of dividing by 10 and producing a quotient and remainder, we find the nearest multiple of 1,000 and subtract that off from 15,900, producing the remainder of 900. There are many, many ways to speed up these operations. For example, I'm sure you've noticed that 7,200 and previously 72 are being computed twice. I want to go through several ways that you can save time here, and this way, observing that you've computed something twice, is one of the most productive ways to save time in basic arithmetic and in much fancier arithmetic, as you'll see many examples of. The squaring speed up here is noticing, hey, we don't have to compute 8 times 9 twice, we can just compute it once and double the result. If you look at another example here, the coefficient of t to the 4th inside the square of f0 plus f1t plus f2t squared, etc., that coefficient is f4 f0 plus f3 f1, etc., plus f0 f4, which is the same as f4 f0. So you might as well just compute f4 f0 once and then double it. And similarly, compute f3 f1 once and double it. f2 f2 you compute once and don't double it. There's some tweaks here. For example, instead of doubling each intermediate result and adding, you just add all of the results that need to be doubled and then double the sum. Actually, even a little bit faster than that is first compute 2F1, 2F2, 2F3, and so on. You don't need 2F0. And then multiply those pre-computed doubles by some other F in an appropriate way, giving the same result. If you count carefully exactly how many operations here, then you can see this saves a little more time than the previous method. If you scale up to squaring polynomials with, say, n coefficients, then you can see that this squaring speedup produces about half the time for squaring compared to multiplication. Sometimes people talk about SM ratios, IM ratios. These are the ratios of times between S would be squaring and M would be multiplication. The SM ratio, S is the time for squaring divided by M, the time for multiplication. I'm saying here that if you're looking at reasonably large integers, if you want to square reasonably large polynomials, then you can eliminate half of the work, producing a square to multiply ratio, SM ratio, of 1/2 as your numbers get bigger. Actually, for lots of reasons, people quote larger numbers for SM ratios, such as 0.8 or perhaps 2/3, but you can see that as your numbers get bigger and bigger, this trick, if there weren't any other tricks in the world, would save half of the time in your square. Here's another speedup. Instead of having digits 0 through 9, instead of following the child's answer for how are integers represented, it's very convenient to use a different set of digits, digits minus 5 through 5. Instead of performing the division of 159 by 10 with remainder, as I've written up here, remember 159 was divided by 10, producing a remainder of 9 and a quotient of 15. Or in the scaled version, instead of finding the nearest multiple of 1,000 below 15900 and then subtracting to produce an output of 900, you can find the closest quotient, the closest multiple of 10 or 1,000 without worrying about whether it's above or below. Here I've taken 159 and divided by 10, producing 15.9, which I round up. I round to the nearest number, 16, which produces a smaller remainder, smaller in absolute value, namely minus 1. And similarly, 15900, I can find the closest multiple of 1,000 without worrying about whether it's above or below. Then the remainder is minus 100. In other words, as I said before, you can use digits minus 5 through 5 instead of 0 through 9. When I say minus 5 through 5, you might object, wait a minute, there's too many of those digits. There's 11 digits instead of 10. So your representations of integers are not unique. But that's okay. You don't have to work with unique representations of integers. If it's more convenient to work with something that you could squeeze a little bit more, then that's okay. You don't have to go to the effort to find the smallest possible representation of your numbers, some unique representation, until you output the answer at the end of a big computation, and then some cryptographic protocol will tell you to reduce your answer to a unique form. Inside your computation, you don't have to reduce to a unique form. The reason to reduce numbers is to make your subsequent computations faster, not to make the results unique. So you can use these digits instead of 0 through 9, and that has a bunch of little advantages. If you want to handle negative integers, suddenly it's very easy. If you want to negate an integer, simply put minus in front of each digit or remove minuses from digits that have them. If you want to subtract integers, it's just like addition. Also, the products that you have to work with are a little bit smaller. Suppose you square a polynomial where each coefficient is 0 through 9. How big are the products of those coefficients? Well, they're 0 through 81. And then you add up some of those. What if you take minus 5 through 5 instead? Products of minus 5 through 5 are minus 25 through 25, which is a smaller range. As your digits get bigger, this is actually a reduction by a factor of 2 in how big your integers are, your coefficients that you have to work with, and that saves time. There is a disadvantage that, of course, you have to write down negative numbers. Overall, the benefit generally outweighs the cost of using these negative numbers. Did anybody hear about the Intel Pentium division bug years ago? This is still on the negative number topic. They were using digits minus 2 through 2 in performing divisions inside the Intel Pentium. Actually, I think they still do this. and it's quite a good method of implementing hardware for doing divisions, to use digits minus 2 through 2 in base 4. All right, the next idea is delaying carries. And this is another big speed up, which saves quite a lot of time in performing a sequence of operations. Suppose that you want to not just multiply A by B, A and B being integers, but you also want to square some other polynomial, some other integer, C, and then add the results. I've told you how to multiply. You multiply the polynomials for A and B, and then you carry the results, producing the integer product, A times B. And then I've told you how to multiply C by itself. You square the C polynomial and perform some carries. And then to add the results, well, you add the polynomials and then perform a carry. For example, suppose A is 314, which is represented as 3t squared plus t plus 4, and B is 271, represented as 2t squared plus 7t plus 1. Then the product, A times B, is computed by multiplying the polynomials, obtaining the 6t to the 4th, etc., that I've written down, and carrying produces 85,094. That's 314 times 271 is 85,094. As for C squared, I already did that computation. 839 squared is 703,921. And then adding these results, 703,921 plus 85,094, you add the individual digits, the individual coefficients, which, oops, requires another carry because you can have results like this 11 that are bigger than 9. And carrying the 11 actually produces a chain of carries here. 11 turns into 1, carry 1, 10, carry 1, 9. The final result, AB plus C squared, is 789,015. All right, I said there's a speed up here, which is delaying carries. You can just wipe out the first two of these three carries, and that saves time. Instead of performing a carry exactly when I told you at the end of every multiplication, at the end of every addition, you can just multiply the polynomials, square more polynomials, add the results, subtract, do whatever you want to the results, and then finally carry. Here I've written down the product of the A and B polynomials, and then add the square of the C polynomial to it, obtaining the AB plus C squared polynomial, which then you carry to obtain exactly the same result, 789,015. All of the carries here, the three carries, have been replaced by just one. And of course, that's a huge savings if you spend any noticeable amount of time on carries, which in cryptography we certainly do. This eliminates, well, in this case, two out of the three carries. There is a little disadvantage here, which is that you have to work with slightly larger numbers. For example, this 171 in the middle, 153 plus 18, that's bigger than any of the numbers we produced before. But the cost of handling that slightly larger number is outweighed by the benefit of being able to skip two out of these three carries. At the bottom here, I've tried to say what the principle is for when you should do carries. If you're about to multiply polynomials, then you're going to have to take their digits, their coefficients, and multiply those coefficients. If those coefficients are big, then that's going to be a lot of work. So before you multiply or square a polynomial, you want to carry the coefficients. Make sure that the coefficients are small. But if you're about to add or subtract or do some operation where you don't pay such a penalty for having big numbers, then it's not generally a good idea to carry. If you have a lot of additions, a lot of subtractions, then your numbers do start getting big and it becomes important to carry on occasion. But usually the only time when you should carry is right before a multiplication or a squaring. And that saves quite a bit of time. Another savings, Karatsuba's method. Suppose that you have, this is a speed up in the polynomial side of things, suppose you have two polynomials, f and g, which each have 20 coefficients. Degree of f is at most 19, degree of g is at most 19. The obvious way of multiplying f by g is to multiply each coefficient of f by each coefficient of g. That's 20 times 20, 400 different products, and then add them in the usual way, which if you count carefully, is 19 squared, 361 additions of coefficients. Here I've written down a faster method, and I'll tell you on the next slide how much faster it is. Suppose we decompose f as f0 there is the first 10 coefficients of f, and f1 is the next 10 coefficients, with the t's in there. So if f is 3 plus t plus 4t squared, etc., then f0 is 3 plus t plus 4t squared, stopping at t to the ninth, and then f1 will take the remaining coefficients, divide them by t to the tenth. You can split up g in the same way into two pieces, g0 plus g1 t to the tenth. Now, if I multiply f0 plus f1 t to the tenth by g0 plus g1 t to the tenth, the easy way to do it, the obvious way to do it, would be multiply f0 by g0, multiply f0 by g1, f1 by g0, f1 by g1, add the results appropriately. Here I've written down a different formula, which has only three multiplications of the big F and big G's. Here I've written down, well, f0, g0, f1, g1, but instead of f0, g1, and f1, g0, I've written down f0 plus f1 times g0 plus g1, and then added and subtracted things in a way that you can easily see produces the right result. How much work is this? How much savings is there? Well, you can carefully count the number of additions, subtractions, multiplications. There are, for example, 10 additions of the coefficients of f0 to the coefficients of f1, and another 10 for g0 plus g1. And then the bulk of the work is the three multiplications of f0 by g0, f1 by g1, f0 plus f1 times g0 plus g1, each of which involves 100 multiplications of coefficients for a total of 300. And then the additions involved inside those multiplications of f0 by g0, for example, well, each addition, each multiplication, rather, of, I didn't do it, involves 81 additions of coefficients times 3 is 243, and you keep going and count exactly how many additions and subtractions there are in the rest of the computation. You end up with a total of 300 multiplications instead of 400, and 310 additions instead of 361 additions of coefficients. So that's quite a lot fewer operations, something like 20-25% fewer operations. There is a little penalty. As before, the sizes of the intermediate numbers we have to work with has become larger. Here, f0 plus f1 is a little bigger. Each coefficient is a little bigger than any of the coefficients of f, at least the bound on how those polynomial coefficients could be, is a little bigger than it was before. But that cost is outweighed by the savings of doing many fewer multiplications and additions of coefficients. Of course, as your polynomials become larger and larger, instead of doing size 20 multiplication using three size 10 multiplication to size, starting to get serious noise from the speakers here, sorry about that, you could do size 40 multiplication using three size 20 multiplications, which are done by the same method recursively. You should do it recursively as it saves time. There's all sorts of additional methods to save time in polynomial operation. Constant number of coefficient operations to compute a product of n coefficient polynomials. Now, the log n and log n, certainly asymptotically, when n is big, this is much smaller than n squared. But if n is small, then it's not so clear whether these fancy methods save time. For example, Karatsuba's method certainly saves time for products of polynomials. All right. So you think if I stand at exactly the right place? Okay. That would be best. Okay. So, experiment with we use 2 to the 3, 2 to the 4, 2 to the 24. Well, this is where you really have to look at your platform, your CPU or your circuit or what platform, what target you're using for your cryptographic software. I have a typical example here, and on the next slide, some more examples of common platforms for cryptography. The Athlon 64 has a built-in 64-bit integer multiplication instruction, which means if you have two integers up to 64 bits each, then you can compute the product of those, 128 bits, in just 2 clock cycles. If you have a 2 gigahertz machine, then a clock cycle, there are 2 billion clock cycles per second, and in 1 nanosecond, you can compute a 128-bit product of a couple of 64-bit integers. I have a parenthetical note that the latency here is 5 cycles. You don't actually get the result back in 2 cycles. You get it in 5 cycles, but every 2 cycles you can start another multiplication if you have some independent multiplication to do. So parallelize your computations. Make sure that you keep the CPU busy with lots of different multiplications. You need at least 3 multiplications going at the same time to keep this multiplier busy. I've also written down that the cost for addition is pretty small. In a few cycles, every few cycles, you can compute a 128-bit product and add that product to some previous sum. If you want to compute F0, F4, plus F1, F3, plus etc., you can do that rather quickly on the Athlon 64. On the CPU, it's a good idea to use radix 2 to the 60, 2 to the 59, 2 to the 61 are also pretty good choices. The reason that radix is good is that if you multiply a couple of coefficients, but as long as you use a radix that's somewhat below the square root of your product size, then you can comfortably fit a sum of several products into your product size, into your 128-bit. Radix 2 to the 64 is not nearly as good because if you multiply some numbers up to 2 to the 64, you have each individual product being up to 2 to the 128, and then you can't add 2 of those. The cost of using a slightly smaller radix and having slightly more coefficients to work with is outweighed by the benefit of being able to add many products without doing carrots. Some more examples of CPUs out there. Much smaller CPU where people often care about the speed of cryptography, the Intel 8051, has just an 8-bit multiplier. Multiplying two 8-bit integers, getting a 16-bit product, takes 4 cycles on that CPU. There's no bigger multiplier. You could have a radix of 2 to the 6 fits comfortably into that. If you have coefficients between 0 and 2 to the 6 minus 1, multiply them and add some of those. It still fits into 16 bits. You might also like to use radix 2 to the 8, even though I said before radix 2 to the 64. Machine, because the multiplier is not so powerful here, and if you work out the cost of how much are you gaining by moving up to radix 2 to the 8, it's quite a bit versus the cost of doing some extra additions is not so much. This is just one example of how, depending on your platform, you get a different flavor of integer arithmetic time. One intermediate example is the Pentium 4 F3, which if you multiply 32-bit numbers, then it takes a couple of cycles with some gigantic latency, but every 2 cycles you can start a product of 2 32-bit integers, and then adding the 64-bit results you can do in the meantime. On this chip, it's a good idea to use, say, radix. Results, for instance, the previous version of the Pentium 4 version F2, can only start a new product every 10 cycles instead of every 2 cycles. And people often found back on that chip, which was just a few years ago, that their cryptographic software was running quite a lot slower than they were hoping for. The Pentium 4 F3 suddenly made the software quite a lot faster. And also, floating point numbers naturally scale. Remember the 800 and 30 and 9 from before. It's easily supported by floating point units built into CPUs. I have a few examples here of how quickly some chips can compute floating point products. And the numbers look very similar to the speeds from before, but maybe the cycle counts are better and there's a broader range of machines overall producing faster results. Again, these CPUs are not designed for doing integer multiplication. They are designed for doing floating point operations, approximate real number operations, which fortunately are good enough to simulate integer operations. For instance, the Pentium 3 for 2 to the 32 plus 1. Now suppose you add a big number to it. Suppose you add, say, 2 to the 75, or 3 times 2 to the 75 to alpha, which is 2 to the 32 plus 1. Inside a computer with 53-bit floating point arithmetic, which is one common floating point size, 53 bits is not enough to exactly write down the integer 3 times 2 to the 75 plus 2 to the 32 plus 1. That sum is rounded to 3 times 2 to the 75 plus 2 to the 32, with the 1 thrown away. And now if you subtract the 3 times 2 to the 75 that you added, with floating point numbers, if you add something big and subtract it off, you don't necessarily get the same result. And here we're not getting the same result. The 1 that I had originally is thrown away. If alpha is 2 to the 32 plus 1, then this floating point addition is rounded so that the subtraction produces 2 to the 32. And hey, suddenly I've split 2 to the 32 plus 1 into 2 to the 32 is my result here, and 1, which I obtained by a subtraction. In general, if alpha is in any reasonable range, and you compute the floating point sum of alpha and a big number, and then subtract off the same 1. More slides here. Fine. Question is, how do we multiply in the finite field G mod F? One divided by p as a real number. Compute an approximation to 1 over p. And then multiply that approximation by fg, gives you an approximation to fg over p, and then round that to an integer, multiply by p and see how close you were to fg. You'll usually be very close if your approximation had a reasonable number of digits, about as many as p did. And so by adding or subtracting a p, you easily get the floor, the closest integer below, closest integer below fg over p, multiplying that by p, you find the closest integer of, closest multiple of p below fg. Subtracting that from fg produces the product fg mod p. And for me, z mod p is exactly the set 0 through p minus 1 with numbers represented as 0 through p minus 1. This is exactly fg minus p times the floor of fg over p is exactly the product of f and g in this field. I've written down some speed ups here. You might hear about Montgomery arithmetic, Montgomery multiplication, which is the same as two-addic multiplication. Two-addic division by p will save some time. It's a little easier to work with the two-addics instead of working at infinity, but it's basically the same speed, just maybe a little bit more streamlined. But all of these methods of dividing by p, using the definition of take fg and divide it by p, by multiplying by some 1 over p approximation, those are not as good as choosing a p which has a special form. Choosing some p which, I'll give you some examples in a moment, makes the computation of fg mod p quite a lot faster. I said somebody gives you a field for use in cryptography, and your job is to perform arithmetic in that field. Someone will give you, say, a prime key and ask you to perform multiplication and addition and subtraction modulo p. Typically, that p will be chosen so that division by p is very easy. Here's an example where p is 1,000,003. Suppose I want to divide some big number. Maybe this is fg or fg plus something else. I don't remember how I came up with this random-looking number, 314159265358. To divide that number by 1,000,003, instead of doing some complicated division operation, I simply notice that 1,000,000, modulo 1,000,003, is equal to minus 3. So 314159 times 1,000,000 is the same as 314159 times minus 3, which is a very small number, just 6 digits. And then adding on the rest of the input, 265258, I obtain a number which is basically between 0 and p minus 1. Not exactly. I have to add, looks like I have to add 1,000,003 to get exactly the desired result. But it's approximately the right result with very little work. I just had to do a little multiplication by 3 and subtract. And there's my answer. I have a parenthetical comment here that adding and subtracting a few p's produces perhaps timing attacks. If someone might see how many p's you're subtracting or adding by listening to how much time it takes for you to do your cryptographic operations, and that might reveal how big your intermediate number was. If you think that your intermediate operations are secret, then the time you're taking for it might actually leak those secrets. But let's not worry about that. Let's just worry about speed. For speed, and also incidentally handling timing attacks, it's a good idea to not bother adding or subtracting a few p's. This procedure I went through of multiplying some top digits by -3 and adding some other digits is guaranteed to produce a reasonably small number. And I don't need a unique result between 0 and p-1. I just need a small result so I can go on with the computation. Having some extra p's in there doesn't change the results of doing further additions and subtractions and multiplications modulo p. Of course, if you have another operation like output for some cryptographic protocol, then you have to find the right result modulo p between, say, 0 and p-1. I have some slides here on delaying carries versus performing this multiplication by 3. I do want to give at least one example here to make sure it's clear what the division by 1,000,003 looks like in terms of polynomials, but I think I'll skip some of the fancier examples here. If you take the polynomial 314159, 3 t to the fifth plus etc., and square it, then you obtain 9 t to the tenth plus etc., which is almost the square of 314159 as an integer, but you have to do some carries. Before doing the carries, you can reduce. You can take t to the 6th and change it into -3. That's the polynomial operation that corresponds to what I was doing a moment ago with multiplications by -3. Take, for example, that 9 t to the 10th and replace t to the 10th by -2 t to the 4th. That reduces this polynomial evaluated at t equals 10, reduces it modulo 1,000,003, at least partially, and that produces is the result. What happened to that t to the 4th? I had 59 t to the 4th minus 3 times 9, and 59 minus 3 9 is equal to 32? Yes, it is. That's the procedure that turned the polynomial square into this reduced polynomial square. And then carrying produces a reasonably small polynomial representing the square of 314159 mod 1,000,003. You can check here, I've done carries, as you can see, with negative coefficients. You can check that the value of this polynomial at t equals 10 is equal to modulo 1,000,003, equal to the square of 314159. All by very simple operations on the coefficients of these polynomials. Okay, I've got some more complicated examples here of how you can squeeze the result further and save time in the middle, but I think I will skip that in the interest of time for us rather than time for the computer. I also have a couple slides here on non-integer radices, which produce a further slight speed up, which in the interest of time I think I can happily skip. You should be aware that there's some fairly tricky stuff that people do, like instead of working with a radix like 2 to the 12 or 2 to the 13, people work with a radix like 2 to the 12.2. Instead of insisting that the coefficient of t to the I be a multiple of 2 to the 12 I, it be a multiple of 2 to the 12.2 I in the appropriate ring of algebraic integers. And that saves a little more time. Depending on your context, you should adapt the radix to your choice of modulus, to your choice of season. But okay, I don't want to push things over time. Let me finish with a few slides here on other finite fields. Instead of presenting you with a prime field, people will often present you with your mission is to implement some non-prime field. You might take z mod t and then adjoin a root of some polynomial phi, where phi has degrees bigger than 1, and then, okay, you know the definition of field. Zooming quickly through your slides here. Sorry, don't mean to go over time. I think it's better to let people read if they're interested rather than read online later. These are already online, rather than my going over time. Coffee isn't line at 6 root of 3. Of course, that field has 223 to the 6th elements in it, which, like polynomials, each polynomial coefficient reduce. Then inside the computer, you end up working with two levels of polynomial. One level for your coefficients modulo p, and another level for your extension by a root of c. So here I have an example. Suppose you want to do arithmetic in the field z mod 2 to the 61 minus 1, adjoin a root t of t to the 5th minus 3, which is reducible mod the prime 2 to the 61 minus 1. What do elements of this field look like? Well, your coefficients are integers modulo 2 to the 61 minus 1, in other words, numbers between 0 and integers between 0 and 2 to the 61 minus 2, which are represented inside the computer as several individual pieces in some radix. You might choose a radix like one of these non-integer radices that I briefly mentioned before, and then your polynomial coefficients are each polynomials of degree at most 2, three coefficient polynomials in that radix, and then you have 5 of those coefficients. Your elements of this finite field are represented as polynomials with 5 coefficients, each coefficient being represented as a polynomial with 3 coefficients. That's a very typical finite field representation. For small primes t, there's much more to say, but I realized when I was writing the slides that there was no chance I would have time for all that. There's all sorts of things you can do for, say, binary fields. If you write down z mod 2 adjoined t mod some polynomial in t, then there's all sorts of things you can do to make that faster, like batching coefficients and using the fact that squaring is very fast modulo 2, but I certainly don't have time to go into that. So that's my last slide. Thank you for your attention.